Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. There's no place like home, but for too many Americans, there's little chance of owning a home. As of 2016, nearly a decade after the Great Recession ended, home ownership in the U.S. fell to a 50-year low. The odds were and are stacked even higher for African Americans and other minorities. At the same time, wealthy investors and banks have created enormous riches for themselves by slicing and dicing mortgages into risky debts and by evicting working-class Americans. All the while, they are creating an exorbitant system of renting while taking advantage of taxpayer handouts and bailouts. My guest today, journalist Aaron Glantz, connects these trends to the Trump administration in his new book, Homewreckers. Cabinet Secretaries Wilbur Ross and Steve Mnuchin and the president himself are among those who have benefited from what Glantz describes as, and shows to be, a rigged system. Aaron Glantz, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
It's good to be with you.
I should have mentioned from the start that the housing crisis is a subject you have reported on for quite some time in your day job as a reporter for Reveal at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Let's start there. What spurred your interest in this aspect of the economy?
Well, this all started with the election in 2016. You know, I was watching Donald Trump's increasing popularity, running a populist campaign on the right, and also watching the insurgent campaign of Bernie Sanders on the left, both of whom were painting the economy as rigged. An economy that fundamentally does not benefit working people, where regular, ordinary Americans were being left behind. And it seemed like kind of an odd time to be running a populist campaign because on the face of it, things were supposedly doing great. You know, the housing bust was behind us. Unemployment was low. We had gone through like a million quarters of growth, one after the other. The stock market was up. And yet people felt so uneasy. So I decided to start looking into housing because, as you mentioned in your intro, the homeownership rate in America had continued to slide down. It went down not only during the housing bust in 2008, 9, 10, but it also went down in 2011, 12, 13, went down in 14, went down in 15. And in 2016, it bottomed out at its lowest level in more than 50 years. And so I wanted to know what the causes for this historic slide in homeownership was and who was benefiting from that. Because in America, homeownership is how we save money, right? It's how we retain wealth. We spend most of our money every month on essentials. But, you know, if you have a mortgage and you're paying off your house, you can have equity. And if you're renting, then you're giving that equity over to your landlord.
So as you approach this book, and in your earlier reporting, how much did you view this through a partisan lens and how much did you view it as more of just a general political and economic problem?
Well, I wanted to tell the story of what happened in the 10 years after the housing bust and who benefited from this system. And you'll recall that during most of this period, Barack Obama was the president. So what I found in my investigation, you look at the cover of the book, you know, it's called Homewreckers, and Steve Mnuchin and Wilbur Ross and Steve Schwarzman and Donald Trump are kind of having a party, pulling lots of money out of a house, and there's a wrecking ball, and the publisher designed this, and it's a lot of fun. But remember, when they were doing all of this damage to our economy, Obama was in charge. You know, Obama was the one that under his watch, we made deals that gave billions of dollars in subsidies to these homewreckers, instead of bailing out the American homeowner. So it's partisan in that, you know, the targets are in the White House and the Trump administration right now, but it's bipartisan. I look at the failures of both sides.
Again, my guest is Aaron Glantz, and he is the author of the new book, Homewreckers, and I'll read the subtitle, but I need a deep breath, which is How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists Suckered millions out of their homes and demolished the American dream. So one of the central examples of the broken system that you depict in Homewreckers involves a woman named Sandy Jolly, she becomes a whistleblower, and after many years, she wins an $89 million judgment in a reverse mortgage case. And I'd like you to take our listeners through this story, but only after I play you a TV ad that I think you will know very well.
Hi, this is James Garner for Financial Freedom. If you're 62 or older and own your own home, I'd like to talk to you about something you should know. It's called a reverse mortgage, and it's a safe, easy way to quickly turn your home equity into tax-free money.
So that, of course, was the voice of James Garner. And my question for you, Aaron Glantz, is how do we tie James Garner, the former Hollywood and TV star, to Sandy Jolly and President Trump?
That was what was so amazing about this woman, Sandy Jolly, who was just a regular, ordinary American homeowner who's, you know, her dad worked for the water department. Her mom worked for a company that printed business and payroll checks for businesses, just as kind of like an accountant. And they had a 1,500 square foot home, three bedrooms, two bathrooms, little patch of lawn, and a lemon tree out front. And yet, this one family, their experience tracked so perfectly with everything that happened in our economy before, during, and after the housing bust. So the clip you played was from James Garner, and he was a salesman for this company called Financial Freedom Senior Funding, which offered mortgages that were targeted at elderly Americans, where they would give you some money and then compound interest on the money that they gave you. And then when you would die, they would take the house. That's the business model of a reverse mortgage. And at the time, Financial Freedom was the biggest reverse mortgage company in America. When the global economy collapsed, so that ad, Sandy's father was in his late 70s and dying of cancer, was sitting in his living room watching this ad play over and over again because he and his wife watched a lot of TV. His wife had Alzheimer's. He had cancer, so he knew his wife was going to live longer than him, but he also knew that she was going to need some care. And so this ad appealed to him. So he called the number on his screen. A salesman arrived at the door, and I have a copy of the PowerPoint presentation the salesman used, and it says in the last slide, this red, white, and blue PowerPoint presentation, what's the catch? None. There is no catch. And so they signed on the dotted line, and that was the spark in 2005 before the housing bubble that eventually led Sandy Jolly to confront five different members of the Trump administration, or Trump's inner circle rather, and win an $89 million settlement as a whistleblower for the taxpayers.
This was driven in part because after her father signed that agreement, they lost the house, and she began...
Right.
She began
well,
to
she
fight.
She fought right away. As soon as he signed that agreement, within 3 weeks, he was dead. He went into the hospital for a surgery, and he never came out. And so Sandy went to go figure out what the hell is going on with the family finances, like a lot of kids do. She discovered this mortgage, and immediately she called the mortgage company, and she said, I want to get out of this. And they would not take the money back unless she paid them lots and lots of fees that she had they had tacked on. And she didn't want to pay those fees. It's more than $20,000 in fees. So she sued the bank. And, you know, the American system of justice takes a long time to operate. So while her lawsuit was going on for years, the bank actually failed and the government took it over. The parent company of this company, Financial Freedom, was called IndyMac. You may remember
yes.
It was L.A. Bank that failed. There were lines around the block. It was kind of the first shot across the bow of the housing bust. And the government had to step in and take it over. And then the government was looking for a buyer for this disaster of a bank. And Steve Mnuchin, who's now the Treasury Secretary, he got together a group of investors, including John Paulson, George Soros, Michael Dell, the founder of Dell Computer, and they bought the bank off the federal government. But it was a very odd sale. It was a sale where they paid the government nothing. And then the government, as a condition of the sale, further said that if you foreclose on people and you lose money, then we will pay up to 90% of your losses. And so that is how, you know, Steve Mnuchin, who's now the Treasury Secretary, entered Sandy Jolly's life in 2009.
And the point that you make with this example is not that it was an outlier so much as it is just one of many instances of this type of thing occurring. This is part of the reason that so many Americans are losing homes or because of some of those subsidies that are leaning far in favor of business, they are unable to buy a home in the first place.
Right. I mean, Steve Mnuchin's bank ends up foreclosing on more than 23,000 seniors. They end up foreclosing on more than 100,000 families.
They call him the foreclosure king, right? That's his nickname.
They end up calling him the foreclosure king. In North Carolina, 230,000 families lost their homes in the financial crisis. And 1,500 of them were seniors foreclosed on by Steve Mnuchin's bank. And we wonder two questions. First of all, you know, who benefited from this? Because all those houses didn't just disappear. And number two, why didn't it go another way? Well, the system was set up to benefit the people doing the foreclosing. And, you know, I think we'll probably get soon to some of the real estate speculators who came in and bought these houses and removed them from home ownership. So it wasn't like Sandy's family lost their home to foreclosure and some other, you know, family went and got a loan from the bank and bought the house and built wealth for their family. It ends up being transferred kind of into this Wall Street financial product. And another Trump associate runs a private equity firm that ends up with her house. All across this country, there's now 3 million homes that are owned by LLP, LP, and LLC shell companies. And that was not the case before the financial crisis. So all of these actions that occurred under the Obama administration are having huge impacts now under President Trump. And in fact, the people who benefited from those, you know, decisions under Obama are now running the country under President Trump.
I do want to ask you whether you see much difference in the political parties in terms of their approach. Obviously, you don't look favorably on Trump and the current cabinet, but it sounds like you're not very impressed either by what was done by the previous administration.
Well, I mean, we have to understand that the actions during the Obama administration had consequences. You know, for example, these massive giveaways to bankers and Wall Street speculators. On the other hand, there were some consumer protections that were set up under Obama. We had the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We had new reporting requirements that require banks not to discriminate against people of color and allow us to more easily track that. We had efforts to strengthen something called the Community Reinvestment Act, which incentivizes banks to lend in low and moderate income communities. So there were some good things that we haven't talked about yet that Obama did. And those are the things that the Trump people are now trying to undo. And so I think it's almost like when I was working with my editor and I was saying, well, how do we end this book now that Trump is in charge? He said, well, think about it like it's a heist movie. These people, the home wreckers, you know, Steve Mnuchin, Wilbur Ross, Tom Barrack, Steve Schwarzman, Donald Trump, they pulled off this big heist of all these homes. Then they pulled off an even bigger heist. They stole the White House. And now they are doing what anyone would do after they pull off such a great heist. They're having a party and changing all the rules that they don't like that are still left.
Let's take a break from the party, and we will be right back with more from Aaron Glintz. We're discussing home records right here on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. My guest today is Aaron Glantz. He's a senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. And his new book, Home Wreckers, details the problems keeping Americans from building personal wealth through home ownership. So you were talking about some of the policies that were enacted during the Obama administration in reaction to the Great Recession, and then what has transpired since Donald Trump came in, and some of these key players, such as the Treasury Secretary, such as the Commerce Secretary, are also in charge of our national government. A big piece of your book is dealing with this idea that home ownership since the time of FDR is really the only way working class people can build wealth. I wonder if you could take us through some of the changes from the boom in home ownership to what began to tear at the fabric of that before Donald Trump was even a candidate for president.
Well, I mean, I think that the first, just pause a moment, because I think home ownership has gotten a little bit of a bad name because of the housing bubble that we experienced a little over a decade ago. And then there was a sense, and it is true, that a lot of people were just using their homes as piggy banks, taking on loans they couldn't afford. And, you know, that plus a lot of other things crashed the whole global economy. But the fact remains that home ownership is really the only way that most working Americans have to build wealth. According to the census, the average homeowner in this country is worth $200,000. The average renter is worth $2,000. So this is not because homeowners make 100 times more money than renters. It's because homeowners are able to save money by putting it in their house, whereas renters are giving 30% of their income or 40% of their income every month to their landlord, and their landlord is benefiting from that wealth. The average American spends 80% of their money on just five things: housing, food, transportation, clothing, and one other thing that I'm forgetting, but the only one of those things that appreciates in value is housing. So that is why home ownership is so important. And as you mentioned, this tracks back to FDR. Back in the Gilded Age, the 1890s, turn of the century, the home ownership rate in America was very, very low. The home ownership rate in Omaha, Nebraska, was 20%. And that's because banks like J.P. Morgan, like the original J.P. Morgan, did not make loans to people to buy homes. They made loans to Rockefeller and steel magnates like Andrew Carnegie. And Roosevelt changed that. During the Depression, he founded a government-run bank called the Homeowners Loan Corporation. It helped more than a million Americans stay in their homes. It invented the long-term fixed-rate mortgage, where you pay off your loan slowly over time and eventually own your house. They refinanced one out of every five mortgages in urban America. And when they did have to foreclose, they sold the bank off to an individual homeowner who would then live in the house, and they financed that buyer rather than bundling them and selling them off to speculators. Then after the war, we had the GI Bill that helped more than 4 million veterans buy homes. And importantly, both of these programs were very fiscally responsible. The government-run bank, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, made money for the taxpayers as people paid off their loans. The GI Bill basically broke even. But when we faced a similar catastrophe to the Great Depression and the financial collapse, we didn't do any of those things. Instead, what we did was we shoveled money at Wall Street. And so the people who got the benefit of all of that investment were not all of these families that that benefited, you know, 80 years ago during the Depression. It was a very few people, you know, who I'm calling the home wreckers.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned several times that is important for people to keep in mind is that while that program you just outlined that was created by FDR did drive a lot of American wealth and home ownership, the one thing that it did not do was treat people of color. All minority groups were almost always left out of this growth. And at the same time, you point out that redlining, this practice of not providing home loans or providing home loans at onerous rates simply because a person is an African American or another minority, that has seen a resurgence of late. What is driving that? How is that happening 50 years after President Johnson had passed legislation to require fair housing?
Yeah, you're right. The New Deal programs of Franklin Roosevelt were incredibly racist. And there were government employees who drew lines on maps that specifically left out neighborhoods of color. And the language that was used is incredibly disturbing to read. Neighborhoods are deemed hazardous because they're infiltrated by Negroes or threatened with Negro encroachment. Jews and other immigrant groups were similarly treated. And as you mentioned, then we had the civil rights movement, and discrimination was banned, and progress slowly, slowly was made after President Johnson signed the Fair Housing Act in 1968. But what we saw in the housing bubble that preceded the bust was a surge in what people have come to call reverse redlining, where lots of loan products were made available to people of color, but they were the most predatory of products. These were the ones with those, you know, resetting interest rates. You get the low teaser rate and then suddenly it would go way up. Or reverse mortgage, where you end up with less wealth at the end than you started with. Or, you know, they call them these 80-20 loans, where you take out, basically put no money down, and you get one loan for 80% of the value, and then another loan for 20% of the value, and then you're basically just paying interest. It's like a high-interest credit cards. You never are gaining any wealth. The bank basically still owns the whole house. And those kinds of loans targeted people of color, so that when the foreclosure crisis happened, communities of color were especially wiped out. And the people who benefited from this were the home wreckers. So Steve Mnuchin's bank, for example, One West, studies have been done that showed that up to 70% of his foreclosures were in African-American or Hispanic neighborhoods. On the other hand, his bank almost never made home loans to help African-American or Latino families buy homes. This is a bank that's headquartered in Los Angeles, probably the most diverse city in the country. And over 5 years when Steve Mnuchin was in charge, it helped 3 African-American families and 11 Hispanic families buy homes. So the result of all this behavior, and Mnuchin is not alone in this, is that the African-American homeownership right now is 40%, which is below the level of the Jim Crow era.
That's quite a statistic. Again, my guest is Aaron Glantz. He's the author of the new book, Home Wreckers, and we're talking about the collapse of home ownership in America and what that has done to the economy, not only to the economy, but to the personal fortunes of so many Americans. I want to ask you, obviously, this program is based in Charlotte, North Carolina, which is the number 2 financial center in the U.S. and home to Bank of America, as well as Wells Fargo's largest employment hub. In the book, you write about Jamie Dimon, who is the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, as someone who is perhaps more ruthless than J.P. Morgan himself. And that's a long way of me asking you, what do you say to Dimon and the other bank CEOs who contend that Dodd-Frank and other regulations in place are already too onerous, that they're already too limited, and that is really what causes the problem, the problems for people, you know, for a lot of people when it comes to finance?
Well, you mentioned Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo, I noted in my book, had to pay a huge redlining settlement because during the bubble, during the reverse redlining period, their employees were found to be making, quote, ghetto loans to, quote, mud people. You know, and Wells Fargo is being sued by a number of cities for the way that their foreclosure machines have disproportionately affected communities of color. And, you know, my colleague Emmanuel Martinez and I at Reveal analyzed 31 million mortgage records, and we found 61 cities nationwide where people of color were far more likely to be denied a loan. even when they made the same amount of money, tried to take out the same size loan and live in the same neighborhood. So, you know, without getting into specific policies, I mean, there's a big problem here that requires a solution. And what's concerning is that while we have this big problem in America, we have an administration in Washington which, rather than trying to attack the problem, is moving in the other direction. So the Community Reinvestment Act, which is the law that requires banks like Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and JP Morgan Chase to invest in low and moderate income neighborhoods, is being looted by the Trump administration right now. And they're, for example, most likely going to make it so that banks are no longer evaluated as strongly as to whether or not they have branches in low-income neighborhoods. The Fair Housing Act, which banned discrimination that President Johnson signed over at HUD, Ben Carson is weakening that. The tax bill that they passed has all these special loopholes that benefit corporate landlords who own property through shell companies, so that you would pay less tax collecting rent on your shell company property than you or I would, you know, as employees in our jobs. So, you know, that's the reality of the situation we face in the world today.
And I know that a lot of this has been reported on, has been discussed to some degree or another, but it is not something, certainly the housing bubble, certainly the Great Recession, those were front page topics. But this idea of the system, the unfairness of how this is structured, the subsidies that go over and over and over again to the banks, that has not become a focal point. It is not, it is not dominating the presidential debates. Why does this continue to get short shrift?
You know, this is a key issue for Americans. Americans want the candidates to debate on the economy, right? And so I don't blame the candidates. You know, on the Democratic side, many of the leading candidates, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, they have all released thoughtful, aggressive plans on the housing crisis. Joe Biden has not, but, you know, like the rest of the leading Democratic contenders, I think, have really put forward proposals that would be great to see debated. You know, the Trump administration, as I mentioned, has a very aggressive policy of supporting the home wreckers. I blame the media for choking out discussion of wealth and equity in America. And I think this is one reason why people are so angry at the media, because the media does not answer the questions that they want answered. And in one way, I'm really happy that I was able to come out with this book, Homewreckers, and break some new ground. But I do have to say that when I had this idea to write a book in 2016, I thought for sure that it was so obvious that some other journalist would come along with a major contribution in this area that would be somewhat, that would like scoop me. But what I've seen is that the media is so focused on a very few stories that it is missing out on the things that really matter to most people.
And along those lines, I think one of the most important things that you explore in this book is the idea that if Congress and the administration at the time would have been willing to approve a sort of, I guess, mass relief program for homeowners rather than bailing out the banks to the extent that they did, it would have not only been more effective, it would have been cheaper. Would you talk a little bit about how that would have worked?
Yes. Well, as I mentioned before, under President Roosevelt, when we had the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which invented the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, saved a million homes and refinanced one out of every five loans in urban America. The government made money because the American people, given loans that were not predatory, paid them back with interest. The GI Bill after World War II, which is probably the single most important thing that the government has ever done to build the middle class. It made it, it broke even because, again, people paid back their loans, right? On the other hand, during the housing bust, we just shoveled money at these Wall Street people and they kept it, right? They got the benefit of all of that. And so I think that this is a very important thing for us to be thinking about right this moment, because yes, you know, this happened 10 years ago. Also, we may be headed for another recession, right? We may be in another real estate bubble. This house that Sandy Jolly used to live in that is now owned by a Wall Street firm, that firm is charging $3,100 a month in rent on a 1,500 square foot house. If we hit a bump in the economy and the unemployment rate goes up, they're not going to be able to find someone to pay $3,100 a month for that house. And then, you know, we haven't even talked in this hour yet about the way that these Wall Street firms are borrowing against these homes and using them as piggy banks. If you look at this home in Los Angeles, and there are homes just like this in North Carolina owned by some of the same companies, you will see a $960 million lien on this 1,500 square foot house because it's part of a billion-dollar mortgage-backed security that has been cut up and tranched and sold on the bond market, just like all of those boutique products during the housing bubble. And so right now is the time for us to be talking about, okay, what are we going to do if things go wrong again? Are we going to do the same stupid thing that we did in 2008, or are we going to try to think ahead and not be caught flat-footed and come up with a plan that can really work for most Americans?
That is a perfect segue. When we come back, I want to get into the slicing and dicing and how these companies have really become so distant from the homeowners, excuse me, how they've become so distant from the homeowners themselves and the relationship between the banker and the buyer. More on Charlotte Talks. Stay with us. Our guest is Aaron Glantz. He's the author of Home Wreckers.
I'm Mike Collins. Should Mecklenburg voters approve a sales tax increase for the arts? Join Charlotte Talks for a forum on the tax hike question Monday, October 28th at 7 p.m. at the McGlowan Theater. Details and registration at WFAE.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is Aaron Glantz. He is the author of Home Wreckers, How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists suckered millions out of their homes and demolished the American dream. Right before we went to the break, Aaron, you mentioned this confusing, complex system of slicing and dicing mortgage loans up and then creating all kinds of collateralization, the mortgage-backed securities that people are at least vaguely familiar with from the Great Recession in 2008, in 2007, 2008, into 2009. I think one of the things that might surprise some people when they read your book is how this really hasn't stopped to a great degree. At least that's the way I interpreted what you were reporting.
Yeah, well, I mean, history never repeats itself exactly, right? So what happened was, as you're mentioning, during the boom, there were all these crazy financial products being created where it wasn't just that you might have had a bad loan on your house, but it had been bundled together with lots of other loans traded on Wall Street. So when something did go wrong and you were behind on your payments and wanted to renegotiate, like, you couldn't even figure out who owned your mortgage, right? So that was the world that we were living in 2008, and that's one reason why the economy crashed so hard. So now what we're seeing with home ownership being at its lowest level in 50 years, we're now looking at corporate landlords taking out the same type of debt. So instead of having, you know, 3,000 individual home loans bundled together into a security that's cut up and sold off as debt on Wall Street, what we have is single companies that own tons of homes through shell companies, leveraging all of them together and then selling off the debt. So It's so complicated, but it's a little bit easier to understand if you think about it in terms of one house. So Sandy's house in Los Angeles, 1,500 square foot house in a middle class neighborhood, probably worth about $500,000 today. It was bought on the courthouse steps as a foreclosure in 2013 for about $300,000. A few years later, the corporate landlord that was run by Tom Barrack, who's one of Donald Trump's closest friends, took that house and about 3,000 other houses and leveraged it and took out a $500 million loan against all of those houses. And then that loan, which came from JP Morgan Chase, was then cut up and sold off on Wall Street. Now, time marches on. Tom Barrack cashes out of that company, and now the house is owned by another company called Invitation Homes, which owns about 5,000 homes in North Carolina. And this company, property values have gone up again, on paper at least. So it then takes some of the same homes and it takes out a whole new bundle of debt, $960 million. It uses this new loan to pay off the old one, but now they have like $400 million of walking around money. Everything is okay from a global economy perspective, as long as there's a tenant in that house that's paying rent to this company, because that tenant is paying off this gigantic ball of debt that this Wall Street landlord has taken out against the house. That's the situation right now. So that's not good for equality in America, but it doesn't really threaten the whole global economy. But what would happen if we hit a recession and they couldn't rent that house out for $3,100 anymore, and they couldn't pay off this billion-dollar bundle of debt? And what if housing prices, instead of going up over time, what if they hit a road bump and they went down? Could that happen? Well, it happened not that long ago.
And you're correct. I generalize that into the same thing happening. It is a new system that is causing similar problems would be a much better way to describe it. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about some of the characters in your book. We talked about Jamie Dimon. We talked about Steve Mnuchin. You have Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, obviously President Trump. But you spend some time going into the Trump family and how they built their fortune in real estate, including Fred Trump. I think most people probably know that Fred Trump was a successful developer. What they may not know is that he relied on federal government subsidies to begin to build that empire. Take us through what he did and how he was able to play the system in effect to build his personal fortune.
Yeah, I mean, it's important for us to understand how important the government's decisions are to the economy and where the government puts incentives and then what happens in our world. I mean, businessmen like Fred Trump, the president's father, paint themselves as self-made men. And he was definitely a businessman who started with almost nothing and built an incredible fortune. But the government helped. He was running a grocery store in the outer boroughs of New York when a bank called Laron Krauss failed during the Great Depression. And he did something very similar to what Steve Mnuchin did. He came in and bought a disaster of a bank for nothing and then proceeded to foreclose on all the mostly German immigrant families who had gotten loans from this bank. But what he was really interested in was getting these properties that this bank had loans on for as land so that he could build. And remember that I mentioned the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which refinanced one out of every five loans in urban America and helped a million Americans keep their homes. It also was interested in supporting builders build homes for people. And so it was only because this government-run bank would provide financing for working-class people to buy homes that Fred Trump was able to build row after row of row house in Brooklyn, which was the very first part of his business empire. All of those loans were federally subsidized, and some of them were even made directly by the government. And then as the war ended, and GIs started to come back from the Pacific and from Europe, the government transitioned to not only helping people buy houses out in the suburbs, but also building apartment complexes in the city. And these outer borough towers, the two biggest housing complexes that Fred Trump would ever build, the Beach Haven and Shore Haven complexes near Brighton Beach in Brooklyn, were both financed by the federal government. So basically, the point of this story is that, you know, when the government wanted Fred Trump to build houses for sale so that people could build wealth, he did it because it was where the money is, right? When the government wanted to subsidize him to build apartment complexes so that, you know, young families could rent after the end of World War II, he did that. But at the end of the day, at least we ended up with housing out of it, right? The home wreckers in my book are not providing housing for anyone. They're not creating any new housing. They are moving our existing housing stock around a chessboard for their maximum benefit and creating financial products off of it. They're doing like funny money games because time has marched on and we're so much more, you know, quote unquote, innovative than we were before.
And in your view, is the answer to this as simple as the home wreckers have better lobbyists and more power, and so they are able to convince lawmakers to structure the laws in a way that benefits them the most?
Well, one of the things that people kept saying to me when I was writing this book is that the system has become so complicated that having like a really basic solution, like having the government renegotiate your debt and give you a new loan that's not predatory, or even get involved actively in the housing market, is just seen as too radical. But for some reason, it's not considered radical to take out a $960 million lien on a 1,500 square foot home, right? It's like they're in the room, right? And it's all perfectly normal to them. You know, we at Reveal, we have a radio episode coming out this weekend that's related to the book, where you can hear Sandy Jolly tell her own story. And one of the people I interview in that radio episode is Julia Gordon, who worked for this organization in the government called the Federal Housing Finance Agency. This is the part of the government that during the foreclosure crisis had to figure out what to do with 200,000 foreclosed homes the government had ended up with because we were backing the mortgages. And I asked her, you know, was there any effort at any point to sell these homes off to individual families or local governments or nonprofits or anyone but, you know, Wall Street? And what she said is that that was seen as too much work, right? It's you can just make a deal with Tom Barrack or Steve Schwartzman, that they'll take 1,000 homes. That is so much less work than working out 1,000 deals with individual families. It's just exhausting for the government. They didn't have the bandwidth. They didn't have the resources. But now we're dealing with the costs of that.
Again, my guest is Aaron Glantz. He is the author of the new book, Home Wreckers. I think the first part of your answer was getting at something that seems fairly obvious to me, which is that when you hear people start talking about complexity and you see the terms thrown out, mezzanine loans and all these various financial terms, part of that just feels like obfuscation to confuse people so that they just kind of roll their eyes and move on.
Well, one of the things that I realized writing this book is how little many of the people who are even in this industry understand this industry. So, for example, I've said a number of times in this interview that Steve Mnuchin paid the government nothing for this bank, right? Now, that is obvious to me now, but it was not obvious to actually any of the players. You know, I got a copy of the sale agreement. It was 38 pages long. It had no purchase price in it, right? But it had lots of other language. And so I end up calling around to a lot of people and, you know, on all sides of this deal. And they tell me all the different features of the deal. And I kept asking them, how much did Mnuchin's group pay the government? And they would just give me, they would just say, what do you mean? I was like, you know, like the price, like what was the price? And they're like, oh, I don't know. And then finally I end up sitting down with Sheila Bair, who was the head of the FDIC at the time. And I said, is it true that Steve Mnuchin paid the government nothing? And she's like, well, if you want to put it that way.
So let me interrupt your thought for a moment, because as we get toward the end of the hour, I do want to ask you this. You know, we've laid out a lot of doom and gloom here in this hour, going through so many of the examples that you have unearthed and reported in Home Wreckers. But you come away from this oddly optimistic. Tell us why you are optimistic, why you think this is a situation that can be fixed, why there is hope that maybe more Americans can begin to build personal wealth and buy homes again.
Well, I mean, we've been talking about the initiatives that the government has done in the past, right? That have boosted homeownership and created wealth in this country. And we talked about the programs under Roosevelt. There's no reason we can't do that again. The reason that we have a huge white-black homeownership gap in this country is because those programs, as you mentioned, were implemented in a racist fashion. But, you know, we made progress on that. We passed the Fair Housing Act. We passed the Community Reinvestment Act. There's plenty of examples of us doing the right thing. And since we've already done a lot of the right things, it's not rocket science to go do them again. And seeing, as I wrote the book, how many people at different times put forward really good solutions, that made me very optimistic, because we don't need to come up with some innovative solution. We just need to do the solutions that are already available to us. And so I see writing a book like this as a very optimistic endeavor, because, you know, you're laying out information, you're arming people with that information. And, you know, and oftentimes when you're a journalist and you do that, people read the material and then things change.
And very quickly, what do you think it's going to take to lead to that change? In other words, is public pressure the obvious answer of what will drive this?
Well, I mean, if you look at the Democrats who are running for president, they, many of them, have plans to attack the issues that I'm writing about in the book. There are think tanks that are coming up with ideas to deal with this. I exposed, with my colleague Emmanuel Martinez at Reveal, we did this big package that I mentioned about modern-day redlining around the country. I was invited to testify before the House Financial Services Committee. There is interest in solving these problems. And so, you know, by writing this book, I hope I'm, contributing some information to help us get to those answers.
That is a perfect place to leave it. Aaron Glantz, thank you so much for joining us here on Charlotte Talks.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Aaron Glantz is the author of the new book, Home Wreckers. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Thanks for joining us on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.